Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. Empathy. It's a word we've heard a lot in the past year. Whether woven in the closing arguments before a jury or from elected leaders appealing to the better angels within us, somebody somewhere is calling for empathy. Even President Barack Obama, in his first appearance since the inauguration of Donald Trump, shared his experience of practicing empathy while running for the U.S. Senate.
I had spent a lot of time traveling around the state. And over time, I got to know people in parts of Illinois that would today be considered red. And I lucked out effectively that I was kind of under the radar screen, so political ads didn't characterize me. And people would meet me, even though I'm this Chicago lawyer from a liberal district with an Arab-sounding name, but I'd show up. And then, you know, you'd have a conversation. And you'd talk about their kids and basketball and what was happening on their jobs. And people got a sense that my frames of reference and my values were not so different from theirs. And that gave me the ability to break through some of the assumptions that people might have otherwise had.
This was part of a discussion on civic engagement President Obama recently moderated with six young leaders in his hometown of Chicago. The day before, he met with a group of young men, most of whom already had prison records, and most of whom had already been shot.
What was striking when you sat down with these guys was they're young people. And if you had listened to them talking, you would recognize them as not that different from any other young man, 18 to 24. What was different was their circumstances. You know, they had grown up, in some cases, in foster care, or their mother was a drug addict, and they had been neglected. And so, even within the city boundaries, a lot of times we will characterize our neighbors as something entirely different than us, that we can't understand and that we're afraid of and that we can't communicate with, and political rhetoric reinforces that. And they need to be heard too. And because if the six of you had been in that conversation, you would have come away not saying, oh, these are some thugs or super predators that I can't relate to. You'd actually say, man, that if I had gone through what they went through, I'm not sure how things would have worked out for me either. And that creation of empathy then promises a different kind of civic response and political response than the one that so often we have. So That hearing other people, I think, is vital. And the question is, are there ways in which we can create opportunities to do that for more young people earlier on, before the lines of division start hardening?
But what is empathy? And why do we need it? Merriam-Webster defines empathy as the action of understanding, being aware of, being sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings and thoughts and experience of another,
without having the feelings, thoughts, and experience fully communicated in an objectively explicit manner. Also, the capacity for this. With all the calls for empathy of late, is it that we lack the reflexive response for empathy? And if so, how do we get it? And are we sure that we want it? From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, this is Us and Them, the podcast where we tell stories from America's cultural divides. I'm Trey Kay. Today, what I learned about empathy from a textbook. Every year, 300 communication professionals, academics, researchers, activists, artists, philanthropists, and leaders gather in Gainesville, where the University of Florida hosts a symposium that focuses on social change. It's called the Frank Gathering, named after journalist and communications expert Frank Carrell. And it's described as a way to connect evidence to action for on-the-ground impact. Over 3 days, 40 speakers present their work with the effort of creating positive social change. This past March, I was honored that they invited me to speak about my work on this podcast, and more specifically, on the subject of empathy.
So this is how it happened. It's 1974. I'm a seventh grader, and I'm riding my school bus to John Adams Junior High School. And as we're going past the gate, there is a group of women who are standing just to the side, and they're a bunch of moms. And they've got these homemade signs that say, "Get the dirty books out of the schools." And I'm thinking, dirty books? Are we going to be reading Playboy in school? So this is what was going on. In our county, our local school board of education had adopted a new set of language arts textbooks. Now, this is 1974. We're just, the Vietnam War is still going on. Watergate, President Nixon has just resigned. Civil rights movement, women's movement, all of these things are happening right now. And these textbooks are designed to connect or to relate to a mandate that our state had adopted in West Virginia to address America's multicultural society. So these would have been the first books that students in Appalachia, but in other parts of the nation, would have read Jimmy Baldwin, James Baldwin, Gwendolyn Brooks, Langston Hughes. And with regard to the Vietnam War, they were encouraged to get children to talk about these things and to ask questions, and to maybe challenge authority. The local protesters got incredibly angry about this. They believed these books challenged patriotism, that they undermined the authority of at home, that they had a specific attack on Christianity, and that in many cases, they just believed that they were lewd and vulgar. The local fundamentalist preachers got involved, and they animated their communities. These communities had mothers come out and protest. And these mothers had husbands, and the husbands were often coal miners who came out of the mines, and and they encouraged other union workers, whether they're truck drivers or bus drivers, to go on strike, and it shut down the community or the economy in this area for about seven counties. There was violence. Schools were bombed with dynamite and Molotov cocktails. There were school buses that were sniped at by snipers. They never had children in the buses, but still, there was a message being sent, don't send your kids to school. And to put a cherry on the sundae of all this that was going on, the Ku Klux Klan marched through our city of Charleston and held a rally on the Capitol steps. This is pretty crazy stuff for a 12-year-old kid in this community. And I didn't really understand what was going on at that time, but I've come to believe or come to know in my documentary, the research of my documentary, that this was a message that really went to textbook publishers across the country. And their message was, when we put out textbooks, we do not want something to happen like what happened in Kanawha County, West Virginia. So fast forward 22 years. I'm now in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm in the living room with my girlfriend. She then became my wife. And we were doing the thing that we liked doing most, which was watch documentary pieces on PBS. And there was this fantastic multi-part series documentary called With God on Our Side, The Rise of the Religious Right in America. And it was over several nights, and after the first night, they teased that the next night they were going to talk about the Kanawha County textbook controversy. And I said, honey, we've got to watch this. I lived through this. This is incredible. And there's going to be this woman, and her name is Alice Moore. And back when I was a kid, we thought that she was a freak. She was the school board member who initially challenged the textbooks. And she pretty much kind of unleashed this whole controversy. She was the one who sparked it. And people on my side of the tracks, who were people who supported the textbooks, most of us, we thought that she was crazy. There were like pictures of her, like a witch on a broom. And I said, honey, we got to watch this. And so the next night we were there with our popcorn and we were watching this documentary. And Alice came on, and I remember my first thought was, well, wait a minute, she didn't say something crazy there. Well, but she'll say something crazy later. And then the next time she was on the screen, she said something, and in a way I found that I didn't find what she was saying was crazy, but I didn't agree with her. And then this light went off in my head. And the light, there was a voice that said, Trey, what she is saying is that she believes that she has core values that she believes that are under attack. You have core values. What if you felt that they were under attack? And then I thought, if I was in that situation, I certainly wouldn't want to have people who were diminishing me, ridiculing me, and making me feel as though I was insignificant and laughable. So years later, I made my documentary, and when I was making it, I wanted to reach out and try to get a hold of these preachers and the protesters and the various people, because I didn't think the piece was going to be worth anything if you didn't hear their voices. And the person who I wanted to speak with the most was Alice. And so I tracked Alice down to her home in Tennessee, is where she's living now. And I remember when I first called her on the phone, my knees shook. The phone was ringing, and I was afraid that I don't know, she was going to call me a liberal journalist from the liberal media or something like that, or that she was going to scream at me or yell at me or be the witch on the broom that I thought she was from when I was a kid. But she was really warm, and we talked for a while, and she seemed to like me, and I found that I really liked her. And when I met with her and I sat down, I remember how back in the day she always showed up to events where she seemed so well put together with a nice, smart-looking outfits and pearls, and she just looked fantastic. But as I was sitting with her in her house, she was wearing a house coat and a pair of jeans, and she had a smelly dog by her feet. And I remember doing what we radio journalists do, just stand an arm's length away with a microphone, and she just seemed like a real person to me. So, as was said in the announcement, the documentary came out, it won 3 major awards, and after it was over with, I continued to have my friendship with Alice. We kept talking. And we, at that point, could be more free about what we discussed. So we talked about religion. She wanted to save my soul. We talked about politics. She thought that Barack Obama was a Muslim communist who was not born in this country. We talked about our personal life. She told me about the first time that she was kissed. A real relationship. And we argued a lot, too. If you listen to the Us and Them podcast, Alice is on some of these episodes, and you can hear us argue. And you can also hear us love each other. And what I realized in these conversations and in these arguments with Alice is that in many ways she was giving me a fantastic gift. Every time that I spoke with Alice, it was as though I was putting a face on this other America that I had no way of understanding before. That she was my touchstone for how I could connect with that. And every time that she received a phone call in Acton, Tennessee from her friend Trey, there was a phone call coming to her from her other America. You know, when we made the textbook documentary, I went to Charleston, West Virginia to give a forum, and we had a reunion of the protesters of the textbook controversy. And Alice was there. There were several other people who were on stage. That's actually Alice and I at that forum. And after this was 35 years after the event, and it seemed that the protesters and the book supporters had not progressed at all in 35 years. They were still bickering about the same things over and over again. And at some point, an exasperated moderator looked to me and said, "Trey, can you make any sense of this?" And all I could do was think of how, when I was making this report, I remember driving around in my car listening to Rush Limbaugh. And at that time, the Senate was debating comprehensive immigration reform. And there was a group in the middle of this, if you might recall, called the Gang of Eight: John McCain, Lindsey Graham, I think Joe Lieberman at the time. And Rush Limbaugh was excoriating the Republicans, just giving them grief for compromising. I remember him saying, "I do not want to compromise with liberals. I am not here to reach across the aisle. I am not here to compromise with liberalism. I am here to defeat liberalism." And I remember thinking to myself, defeat liberalism? Is that possible? And if you flip it, can conservatism be beaten? Can it be defeated? And I said to the audience, here we are in the Kanawha Valley of West Virginia. I bet 50, 100, 200 years in the future, there is going to be an Alice Moore here in West Virginia. And there's going to be a Jim Lewis. He was the guy on the face of the book supporter side. And the only way that we're going to get through this is not by defeating one side or the other, but we're going to have to get through this together.
Coming up, more of my speech at Frank 2017. I'm Trey Kay, and this is Us and Them, which is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation.
Music lifts us up and brings us together, even when we can't get together in person. Mountain Stage brings you live performances on the air, online, and in our podcast. They remind you how it feels to be in a live audience listening to live music. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find a link to our stations and our podcast online at mountainstage.org.
As I said at the top of the show, there are always calls for empathy. I think at just about every stage of my life, I've heard at least one person, if not a large chorus of people, calling for empathy on a variety of issues. But last year's bruising, no-holds-barred presidential election produced a victor who has less of an instinct for diplomacy and more of a propensity for reactively throwing sharp elbows. Subsequently, there seem to be voices, who are normally in the empathy choir, suggesting that we dispense of empathy here at the dawn of the Trump era. Just 2 weeks after I'd given this speech, I came across Frank Rich's article in New York Magazine, No Sympathy for the Hillbilly, in which he flatly rejected any calls for reaching across the divide or coming together with respect to the victorious Trump supporters among us. As I read the piece, I had to flip back to the opening page to see if it said, No sympathy for the hillbilly. I'm looking at you, Trey Kaye. I gotta say, it seemed like he was addressing me and the work that I do. I know that there are many Americans out there who didn't elect Donald Trump and who agree with Frank Rich and who feel that the stakes are too high, the behavior too heinous, the statements too divisive for us to empathize with those who put this man in office. Do they have a point? I don't know. To be clear, empathizing doesn't mean normalizing extreme ideas or accepting offensive behavior. But it does mean talking to one another. The Tea Party was determined to stonewall their opposition, that is, liberals, at every turn. To negotiate, compromise, or even appear together was seen as a betrayal. So now, is it the liberals' turn? And if it is that their best move? Well, if we're going to continue the inevitable zero-sum teeter-tottering gains and losses among Republicans and Democrats, then perhaps the only thing that matters is to win, to put the progressive agenda back on the rails. But if we're going to come together as a nation, can we afford to ignore our neighbors in the community, only to meet them on the battlefield every other November? What do you think? Could you let us know by recording a voice memo on your phone and emailing it to me, trey@usandthempodcast.com. Now back to the Frank 2017 gathering for the conclusion of my speech. What I learned about empathy from a textbook.
When I do this work, sometimes it is really hard. I've heard a lot of talk this week about the presidential election, and a lot of people seem still to be in despair over it, somewhat. I am. And it took a big toll on me mentally and physically. And I've this year done something that I've really never done in all my life. Everybody has been saying, Trey, you need to start meditating. This is the year I started. And I do it every morning. I did it this morning. And I pray a lot. And I pray before interviews. Sometimes the interviews, I meet with people who are so entrenched in their beliefs that they're unmovable. And that's the time when I pray the most, and that's the time when I meditate the most. And the prayer that I pray, it's just a very simple prayer where I say, Thy will, not mine, be done. And when I say that, it's not really a religious thing. I know we say words like thy or something like that. It sounds like we're invoking the Bible or something like that. But it really is for me just being cognizant that there is something bigger. There is something bigger in the work that I'm doing, and that I am here not to score a big interview, not to win another Peabody Award, that I am here just to do service with these interviews. And sometimes I feel when I employ this empathetic, understanding approach in my journalism work, I feel that those hard interviews, those people sometimes melt a little bit. And sometimes I melt a little bit as well. And then there are some times where sometimes it's just a little bit too hard. Recently, I was in Charleston, South Carolina for the penalty phase of the Dylann Roof trial. And my work or my assignment was to connect with people maybe from his family or from people who were the families and friends and survivors of the victims. This was incredibly difficult work, especially when connecting with the victims' families. They see people like me not as, as a them, really to their us. When I was with them, I was very aware of my skin tone, and I was very aware of the fact that they saw people in our profession, journalists, as somebody who was looking to exploit their stories. It was really difficult work at a time where I was being seen as a them to their us, when I really felt that I was on their side, and all I wanted to that we could agree on, that we were us and not us and them. There was one day, it was the day after the jury had decided that Roof was going to be given the death sentence, and I had a meeting scheduled up at Mother Emanuel AME Church. And I was meeting with somebody, and I had no idea that the victims' families were meeting in the church parking lot to get on a bus to go and hear the formal sentencing. And while I was there, I happened to be standing a few feet away from a man who I'm assuming was one of the survivors' families, and I just greeted him good morning. And as I did that, a woman came out of the church, and she came like a guard dog, just kind of charging at me like, "Who are you? What are you doing?" And she just kind of shooed me off of the lot as though I was some type of interloper. And my adrenaline just pumped up, and I didn't feel like I was there doing any harm, and I didn't mean any harm, but I got and I understood exactly what it was that she was concerned about. She was really being protective of this man. That I went and I did my interview just after that. And I came back, after the interview actually went very well, and I came back to Mother Emanuel Church because I had one more appointment with them before I left town. And as I re-entered the parking lot, my knees were shaking. I felt like this work that I was doing just seemed so out of line, seemed that it was striking a wrong chord. And I remember knocking on the door, the very door that Dylann Roof walked through on the night that he committed his atrocities. And I greeted the person who was there to meet with me. And she said, "Hello." And almost as soon as those words came out of her mouth, I just broke down and started crying. And she said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "This is really hard. This is really hard to be spending here all week hearing loved ones talk about the people that they've lost, to spend time here in this room where that loss took place. This just is a really, really difficult story to tell." And at that moment, I realized that I was practicing a different type of empathy, different than sitting with Alice with the smelly dog at her feet and just listening to her story. This was a time where I had to realize that true empathy was about knowing when a story is not ready to be told, and when somebody is not in a place where they need to be badgered to tell it. You know, sometimes I feel that in this work that I do with the Us and Them podcast, I am somebody who is trying to save the world. And I realize that sometimes when that is your intention, if you are to do it right, sometimes you need to know that in doing so, you are the one who might need to be changed. Thank you.
You've been listening to Us and Them. This episode was produced by Mitch Hanley and me, Trey Kay. Thanks to Ann Cristiano of the University of Florida's College of Journalism and Communication, who is the instigator behind this wonderful Frank gathering. It truly was an honor to be invited. And special thanks to Eric and Tevi for coaching and helping me shape the talk that I presented at Frank 2017. If you'd like to see the video of my speech, or any of the other speakers from this year's gathering or previous gatherings, we've posted a link at our website at usandthempodcast.com. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them theme music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Rita Krasoffi and Mariana Trofimova designed our website at usandthempodcast.com and provide images for the web. Our intern is Nicholas Tantillo. The wonderful people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. See you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.